listener production.
Okay, are you recording?
You are beautiful because you are listening to episode 206 of the Howie Games Part A featuring,
what about this,
the US Masters champion, John Rahm.
Rahm wins the Masters Marathon.
John was one of the biggest sports stories on the planet in 2023. He dominated the early stages of the US PGA Tour, winning three times in 6 weeks before he took out the US Masters, then later in the year stunned the golf world, stunned the sporting world when he joined the LIV Tour. The LIV event in Adelaide last year, if you missed it, it was huge. The joint was pumping, it was modern, it was entertaining, it was engaging, and it was accessible. For mine, it is brilliant that the LIV Tour is giving more people in more places the chance to see top-line golfers in action, give the fans what they want.
So you search and try to find, but you don't know where to go. So many thoughts flood through your mind, you're confused and want to know. Mystery, what is to be? So much more than meets the eye. Listen to me, time is your key. You will find out by and by.
You can see John alongside Cam Smith, Mark Leishman, Phil Mickelson, Brooks Koepka, Dustin Johnson, all the LIV players in action once again in Adelaide, April 26 to 28 at the beautiful Grange Golf Club. Tones and I is playing on Friday. Old mate Fisher hits the stage Saturday, and Flight Facilities will be playing on Sunday. Additional tickets, limited hospitality, and a premium VIP viewing package for all three music acts now released due to overwhelming demand, so you can see the golf and the entertainment. Do not miss out. All you need to do is head to livegolf.com/events/Adelaide-2024 for tickets. You can see the link in the show notes. You can also see all the LIV Golf on the Seven Network. A lot of love to Nipua Sharma and Sammy McLaughlin from TLA and the entire LIV media team for making this episode happen. Rightio, let's get to it. Enjoy the story of John Rahm Ramirez. Pumped to have this man on.
So when you search and then you find and know just where to go and thoughts that once used to cloud your mind, you see clearly and now you know. Mystery, what is to be revealed in King Selassie I. Come on children, trot with me, we want to reach Mount Zion I.
Well, this is a treat. We've had one previous Masters winner on the Howie Games. His name is Adam Scott. Now we've got the former number one, the current Masters champion, a man that has moved to LIV Golf. He's one of the biggest sports stars on the planet. We met about 18 seconds ago. John Rahm joins on the show. John, great to see you. How are you going?
How are you doing? Howie, it's great to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
Mate, I'm pumped you're on the show, so I'm on a short break up in northern New South Wales in Australia at the moment. You are coming in from Saudi Arabia, yeah?
We're in Saudi Arabia, yes.
Okay, so tell me, I'm privileged to travel around covering sport, a sport called cricket, which you wouldn't know much about, and I've just been in India. I love to get out and explore things. Are you a man that gets out and explores the places you go, or are you stuck between the hotel and the golf course?
This is a mix. Sometimes the course and the hotel we're at are a little bit too isolated, and that happens more often than you think. So we just don't really have the time, right? It's not like... golf usually takes quite a bit of time, so when you wake up, work out, do media, practice, it's a little bit too late before you can actually go and do something. So it all depends on the week. If I can, I will. If not, obviously, it's not my top priority.
And there in Saudi Arabia, we hear so much about Saudi Arabia, 99.5% from my perspective, John, from people that haven't been. So you're there. Tell me about your impressions of the place.
Tell you right now. If I took a picture out of my window in the resort looking out at the Red Sea, you'd have no idea this is Saudi Arabia. Now,
right.
If you turn around and look towards land, obviously you're going to see a whole lot of sand, but that's the desert for you, right? I mean, that's the same with Arizona. So it's quite different, right? Landing in yesterday into Jeddah, I had no idea how big of a city it was. You could see the traffic throughout the city. It's different. It's different than I thought it was going to be, right? I've been fortunate enough to be in the UAE and be in Dubai and have an idea, but it's a lot more modern in a lot of places than I think a lot of people would expect. It's a lot safer than a lot of people would expect. It's gotten a bit of obviously negative press, a bit more than it maybe should have. And I think if somebody who hasn't thought about it opens their mind a little bit and thinks about possibly coming to places like this, they'll be gladly surprised.
Well, mate, I hope you get to get out and about and explore it. Now, we've got a limited amount of time. I want to speak to you about your golf journey. But from what I can see, you played golf in Australia once before, the World Cup at Kingston Heath. Is that the only time you've played here?
Only time I've been to Australia. I did go early and enjoyed playing at New South Wales Golf Club. So I've been able to play at least one other golf course in Australia while I was there.
And now you are coming to Adelaide, 26th to the 28th of April. Tickets still available, limited corporate tickets. It's on the Seven Network. From what I can see, Liv is bringing a whole new level of entertainment to golf, which I love. I think they're going to love you, John, and they'll call you Johnny over here. Well, you got to realise when you get here, they're going to call you Johnny because you're a man that plays with passion. I'm sure you've spoke to some of the Aussie boys about it. Have you heard much about Adelaide? Because they're going to love you. They're going to love you in that joint.
I can tell you right now, from anybody I've spoke to related to Liv and players, you know, management, everything, I think Adelaide was unanimously favorite tournament last year. We all saw the images, we all saw the watering hole, we all saw the atmosphere. So it was my number one destination looking forward to. Obviously, Valderrama is something where I want to play, but I know the golf course. I kind of know what to expect in Spain. Australia, I don't know what to expect, right? I haven't been there since 2016 or 17. So my memory is incredibly good. Kingston Heath is one of my favorite golf courses in the world, and I've heard this one is also amazing. So I can't explain how much I'm looking forward to this one because it seems like it's going to be a lot of fun.
And I think this is one of the great things about Liv. Greg Norman came on this podcast, John, a year and a half ago and dispelled a lot of the myths about Liv and gave his reasons about why he was involved.
Now, remember this too. Liv Golf is a global platform. So the PGA Tour is just in the US. So to me, it's paramount that we keep Liv Golf around the globe. So now just think of that opportunity that we have. We have growing that base in South Africa, in Australia. We're going to be doing it in Asia. We're going to be doing it all through Europe. We have been the leader in the game of golf, Howie. Never in the history of the PGA Tour that I know of did they inject hundreds of millions of dollars in prize money like that.
No.
Right? It was because of Liv. And unless you have competition, you're going to have a monopolist, and that monopolist is going to try and hold on the best he can in any way, shape, or form he can possibly do.
I think the fact that in Australia in the past, unless it's the President's Cup, probably we haven't seen the creme de la creme of world golf, and now we do. And I think that had a real impact on the Australian sports fans last year. So it's great to see the level of golfers that we now get to see thanks to Liv, which, you know, as I said, mate, there's so much talk about it, but I'm a massive fan of the fact you guys are here and you're coming and you're entertaining.
You know, I think it's one of the big objectives of Liv Golf and one of the reasons why they decided to transition, right? It's playing golf in places that I haven't played before. Very simple. And there's a lot of golf communities that deserve a bigger level of golf that they never got to see, right? I mean, you have three of the four majors in the US, and before you had WGC, some of them were outside, but for the most part, you're playing in some countries in Europe and the US, right? You never really get out of that. So to be able to enjoy Saudi Arabia this week, Hong Kong next week, and then we have Adelaide and Singapore, it's amazing. And you get to be exposed, and you expose golf to a crowd that maybe hasn't seen it before, or a crowd that is hungry for golf. And Australia always seemed like that type of place. I mean, I remember growing up watching golf and seeing some of the best players in the world going out there in December to play the Australian Masters, Australian PGA, and the Australian Open, right? And the last few years, that kind of died down. COVID obviously had a lot to do with it. And it's great that we're back in there and to see that, you know, Australians want us there and want to see the best golfers in the world. And as players, you want to entertain a crowd that wants you there. That's nothing more fun than that.
Well, it's going to be great to have you here. I guess it's been a really interesting period for golf for the last 3 years because, like many sports, it's been torn in a couple of directions. Before we get to why you decided to join Liv, and congratulations for signing and setting up your family for generations to come, which we'll get to, mate. Massive congratulations and reward for your talent. How has it been the last few years as a professional golfer while in some ways the sport's been torn apart. Now, hopefully it gets joined back together, but how's that being a professional in that environment, John?
Well, no change is easy, right? And I think in both sides, there's a lot of question marks, a lot of unknowns, and that can be unsettling for a lot of people, right? So I think 90% of the players fall under that category, where they don't know what's going on and they're just spectating, waiting to see what happens. When it comes to the change, well, I think as humans in general, we just don't like change, but that doesn't mean it's a bad thing, right? In order to improve anything, you need to change it, right? And that's something to get past, right? If you cannot, as a player and as a golf fan, you need to have the open mind to maybe explore different options and accept that it could be better for everyone, right? And I think that's what a lot of players have done. That's what I certainly did. And I think Liv is making a positive change in the game of golf, right? There's a few differences. You have the shotgun starts, you have the three rounds. But I can tell you as a player, once you're playing and once you're in it, I completely forget that it's only three rounds until people remind me, right? Competition is competition, period. And it's certainly not the first sport to go through it, right? Certainly cricket went through a few changes, right? You have five-day cricket, Absolutely. Now you have one day, and it kind of keeps getting smaller and smaller just because everybody's busy. It seems like everybody's attention span's a little bit shorter. And, you know, having your competition in certain hours of the day is just always going to be easier as a product to sell. So adding that to the change in atmosphere, right? You have a little bit of music and a different vibe. I think it just appeals to a younger generation that maybe didn't have golf in their mind. And for people that haven't seen it, I really encourage to come and watch because it's different and it's fun. It's very, very entertaining. I've always been a golf purist, right? Just loved the game forever. I never wanted to see certain changes and, you know, kind of opened my horizons a little bit by seeing how this just has evolved a little bit and how much more inclusive it is than people think.
Yeah, I think DJ Fisher, an Australian bloke, is playing in Adelaide. Now, John, I don't know what you like out on the dance floor on the disco, but he's a very talented man. I didn't expect to be discussing cricket with you, I've got to say, but take me behind the scenes as much as you can, John. In a snapshot, your thought processes, was there a moment? Did you speak to Greg or another player? What made you decide as the world number one, the Masters champion? You obviously knew the impact it would have on Liv making that decision. As I said again, congratulations on that decision. Well, talk me through it.
All right. How much time do we have?
Well, that's up to you. I got hours, but that's up to you, John.
Well, it's an extremely complicated process to try to narrow down quickly, right? I was never completely against it, even though I had my thoughts about Liv, right? And I made in public, yep. I wasn't the biggest fan of the format right away, right? And I've never wanted to make decisions on my career based on money. But as a father, that mindset changed a little bit. And I realized for people watching this, when I say what I said at the US Open, I was already a dad, but, you know, growing more into the role of a dad, you kind of change a little bit. I got offered a number that I think very few people in this world would have said no to. That to begin with, and get that out of the way, because obviously it's a big part. And to be honest, every athlete in this world usually goes where they get paid the most and where they can win. Luckily, golf is an individual sport. I can still play majors. I can still win. So I don't know why that's such an issue nowadays for golf alone, but that's besides the point, right? You can believe whatever you want.
Well, it shouldn't be, is it? Because like you mentioned cricket, basketball, NFL, every sport, you pay the athlete what the athlete's worth. So yeah, I'm with you there. I don't get the fuss. If the market says you're worth reportedly $600 million as a sign-on fee, then good luck. That's reward for talent in the market, surely.
I mean, that's how I see it, but it's easier for me to say now, obviously, having accepted that. But the main thing was once the PGA Tour made that agreement, right, when the framework agreement came out, when none of us had an idea and all of a sudden that gets published, I think that changed the dynamic. In my mind, it changed, okay, if this is going to be the future of golf, then I owe it to myself to see what's out there and see the product. And then I started asking questions, right? A lot of the people that practice where I practice were in LIV Golf and spend a lot of time with them because they're friends. And I started asking questions and seeing the dynamic. And inevitably at some point, I wanted to hear from higher people. So I did meet with Greg, I met with other management and try to hear out what they had to offer. Because to be honest, up until then, I didn't really know. I didn't know the future vision. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what LIV Golf wanted to do, right? All I heard was basically what media said, which was never a really positive thing, which to be fair, I didn't believe everything they said. So once I got more information, I said, well, this is definitely something to consider, right? And it was a family decision. I would never want to do something that, you know, my wife or anybody in my family would be against. And having their support and going through pros and cons, which I could get into it for a very long time, I ended up deciding to go, right? I think if you look at my stage in my career playing good golf, I just won the Masters, 5-year exemption for all majors, right? My value as a player would say would be an all-time high. I think it was the right time for me to go and maybe be able to make a positive change for the better, right? And hopefully seeing both tours come together again, right? Because at the end of the day, we all want to compete against the best. And I think everybody wants to see the best compete against each other.
Yeah, it's very similar to what Cam Smith said. And I asked this question to Cam, John, and as I said, we've only been chatting 15 minutes, so I don't want to ask it in a crass dollar sense. But I asked Smithy about the responsibility that comes with that type of wealth and what you can do for your family and generations of your family.
The first thing for me was just figure out the family stuff. You know, obviously take care of them. I'd love to do a foundation at home. You know, I'd love to see more kids playing golf, I think, but also, you know, just sport in general. I think the kids need to get out there and run around and play footy and cricket, and I'd love to help those kids out that aren't really, you know, so privileged to do so.
What type of impact? I don't know if responsibility is the right word. What type of impact has that had on you?
So I would only feel comfortable with myself if I invested this type of resource in a way of giving back to the game that has given me so much, right? Like I've said, the game, okay. I love the game more than anything else. So I've said in many interviews for anybody that follows me, what Seve was able to do in Spain and in Europe, right, beyond accomplishments on the golf course was incredible. When he started playing golf, there was only 15,000 licensed golfers in Spain. At the time of that, there was 350,000. Amount of golf courses were incredible. So if I can add on to that in any way possible, right, I think it's also a success. Not only, I usually try to say Spain because I'm from there and I want to give players easier paths to get to where they want to get to. But if I can make an impact anywhere else in the world, it'd be great as well, right? So I've had for a few years, since COVID has been difficult, but we've had what we call John Golf for Kids, which is a bit of a take on the draft chip and putt for younger kids. But I want to be able to involve that, right? Mainly the Spanish Golf Federation runs amateur golf in Spain, but maybe with my rise, I can add on and add more tournaments that people can access to and play and you know, develop themselves on. If I can do it in the US as well, definitely have a few ideas, right? Luckily, I grew up close to a very accessible driving range in Spain, very few public golf courses when I started. So my swing coach back in Spain had a range that you could just go into. You paid a €2 entry, then you could rent clubs or you could just be on the putting green for the rest of your life and that's it, right? So having more accessible places like that, and that would be easier to do in Arizona. There's little things like that that would improve the stage of the game and give people more access to play game and, you know, give somebody the opportunity to be exposed to golf that maybe wouldn't have in the past is where I see myself doing, right? And I think that's the right thing to do for me, for what the game has done for me.
Back to John Shawley. Next up on the show, a man with an incredible football story to tell. He played in Turkey. He played for Crystal Palace. He played in the English Premier League. He captained the Socceroos. He won an Asian Cup, went to numerous World Cups. But it was a struggle at the start for Milay Jedinak when he was trying to get a run in the A-League.
I got in contact with Laurie McKenna, who was at the time Central Coast manager. And I knew Laurie from previously. I'd never worked with him, but I knew of him. And basically he just said, come up here, like there's no guarantees on anything, come up. And then once I got up there, I did the travel from, again, I was working with my uncle, for my uncle, so he was very understanding. And
so how far was the trip?
Gosford to Western Sydney every day sometimes, and sometimes every other day.
You're not getting paid at all?
Nah.
Not a cracker?
Nah.
Petrol money?
No.
Right. So it's costing you to get up there.
Yeah. But again, I think the way I approached it was, to be honest with Laurie and everyone at Central Coast, they were brilliant because I seen the environment. I was like, I want me some of this. Like this is great.
This will be like this.
I can see helping me, you know, take the next step. And Laurie and everyone at the club were very frank with me. They said, oh, at the moment we don't have a slot, but like you're more than welcome. So I was like, okay, brilliant. I'm like, I'll come up when I can. I'll get around it. And that's what I did. I just chipped away at it.
That's Mila Jednak next up on the show. Let's get back to John. What's your first memory of golf? Was it watching on telly? You mentioned Seve. Was it having a hit with your mates or a relative? How'd you get into this beautiful game?
So my dad started playing golf later in life, closer to his 40s. I was young then. And the way my parents say it is they would pick me up from school and they would go get their golf lesson. And they say sometimes I fell asleep, sometimes I had a snack, sometimes I just watched. And then one day I just tried. I think I was around 7 or 8 and I tried to play golf and just hit it, right? And I do have that memory of going up there with the club and trying to hit it. So my earliest memories are, yeah, going to that range and kind of grabbing a golf club for the first time and going through that process that we all go through, right? Of the frustration of not hitting the ball and then learning how to hit it, right? And then shortly after that, my parents got me into lessons with collective lessons with other kids and the love grew, right? Obviously, being from Spain, I think every kid at some point that plays any sports like, oh, I want to be a football player, right? Yeah, that's it. They just want to play football. Yeah. I want to play for Athletic Bilbao, yeah. And that was it. Like, there was no other thing related to sports early on. And once I started playing golf, things changed pretty quickly, right? That's when, you know, I fell in love with the game. There's something special about the game. And probably because it was such a family thing we did, right? I think I had such positive memories with it early on that made me gravitate towards it. And apart from being severely more talented to play golf than to play football on any other sport.
So I often ask this question of the guests that come on this show, John. There's part ability and there's part hard work. Were you, within 6 months or a year, the kid that everyone else was playing against saying, oh, no, we're in the comp against Johnny Rahm, he's going to destroy me? Or were you, you're shaking your head, you're a kid that had to work hard?
No, yeah? It was a slow process. So I started playing at 8, and I think, I mean, we're talking about young ages, right? But I didn't become that player up till I was 14 going on turning 15.
Okay.
But it was weird because I think it was when I hit my growth spurt. It was when I was about 14, right? So it was that it was over a winter. Like, I was okay. I was good in my region. Was able to finish top 5 once at the national level, but I was never the player. And then that winter, I grew exponentially. I grew to pretty much the size I am right now. Maybe not like that, but I mean, at 13, I was definitely, I think, you do meters, right?
We do meters, yeah.
So I was meter 85, something like that. Something ridiculous, right? I went from being average to the tallest in my class by far. With that came a lot of distance and certain improvements when I started seeing my golf coach, Eduardo Thayes, at the time. And I was able to win my first ever national tournament that January of when I was 14 going on to 15. And then I won the national championship.
And what did that mean? What did, as a 14-year-old, what did victory mean to you? Because I want to talk through various victories you've had and what they've meant.
It was my first ever, like, really, like, round in the 60s, I believe, in a tournament that was big. And I teed off way before the leader, shot 4 under, I believe, on the final round, and ended up winning. Right? Nobody expected me. I ended up winning. Like, I was done hours before, and here I'm the champion. Like, the people around my region knew me, but a lot of people in Spain did not know who I was. And then that's when I became a bit more of a name. But then that same year, the Spanish under 16 championship, national championship, was at my home club, hosted by my home club. A little bit of home court advantage. And I was able to win that by 9. And that's when things changed, right?
9 shots!
I won that by 9.
Wow.
That's when my confidence went to a different level. and I became the player to a player to be reckoned with. And hard to explain how I felt. I mean, you're so young. It's like you don't know how to deal with those things, right? I think my first time ever having a lead going into Sunday and shooting a good round and winning by a margin, it was just fun to be able to enjoy the last few holes with, you know, with knowing that I had won it. I don't know how to explain it. It's, I think you're so naive that I almost my thought was, okay, I won more, right? It was more than just that. There's more things to accomplish, and it was early on. But I can't quite remember how. I mean, obviously I felt very happy about it. And I remember feeling almost more nervous for the speech than actually competing.
I'm sure you nailed it. You went on to study in the States. So you go to college in America. So a lot of athletes in Australia in world sports, especially football, John, they move, you know, some of our big-name footballers leave at 13, 14, 15 years of age to pursue their dream. You're obviously a little bit older than that, and I'm sure you'd seen a bit of Europe. I don't know about the world. What's it like as a young man packing up his golf club, saying goodbye to his family, and pursuing golf and education on the other side of the world?
I did spend my last 2 years of high school in Madrid. So I'm from Bilbao, different city, right? So
yep.
I've been away from my parents for a decently long period at a time, and that helped a lot because I grew up speaking in classrooms. I grew up speaking and learning in Basque. I had a transition to Spanish, which was a bigger change than most people would think. So going to the U.S., longer flight, but the change was obviously more difficult, but I had some experience on it already. It's more of a cultural shock, to be honest. I never had time to go and visit. You know, I grew up in a town with 1,300 people and then spent some time in Madrid, but very isolated as part of Madrid. And then I go to Arizona State, which is one of the biggest universities in the world. Grew up in the cold and landed in August in the desert. I mean, the change was about as big as you could ever imagine. And it took me some time, right? Also, the English I was used to was UK English, right? English. That's what they teach you. Right? I'm going to American accents. It was a change. It took a good month for me to settle in. And unfortunately, it showed on the golf course. But once my English got to a high enough level, everything became a lot easier. But it was a solid month of struggle. The first month wasn't easy. But again, I think you're so young and so naive and so immature that you don't know anything different, right? I mean, you just kind of think it's normal and that's about it. I mean, you deal with it. And I remember my coach saying that he didn't think I was going to last more than 2 weeks. He thought I was going to quit and go back to Spain. And I don't blame him because I was quite quiet. But throughout that time and the difficulties, because I got in trouble a lot for honestly just not understanding what they were telling me, I could kind of find my safe space on the golf course, right? And play golf. And even though my first tournament was not great, starting on the second one, things got a little bit better and easier for me. So tough change, tough to be away from family. But again, I think when you're so young, you just don't know anything different.
Yes.
It's almost like at that point, you just want to be away from your parents, right? Like, I don't want somebody telling me what to do. Yes. Right. You don't have to do homework. You can, you know, it's not mom telling you what to do. Like, it's somewhat fun at first. And then once the panic starts hitting in and the problems come in, it becomes very difficult. But there's, you know, there's like, well, I don't have a bedtime. I can do whatever I want.
I've got a 12 and a 14-year-old. I think your kids are a bit younger than that. But trust me, it's pretty early on when they start not really wanting to do what you do. But I'm sure that's coming your way.
I can imagine.
Before we get to the big tournaments, as I said, that I'd like to get your views on how you physically, mentally prepare and that type of thing. What's your first check in golf? I guess you got to be a pro. Like, what's your first time you've won any money playing golf?
So my first pro start was right after the U.S. Open in 2016 at Oakmont, which I played good and I won low amateur. It was congressional. It was at that time the Rocket Mortgage. And I finished third, and my first ever check was $400,000.
Okay. Did you go and buy anything? Like Cam Smith, we mentioned he's into his boats. Are you a spender or did you put it in the bank, Johnny?
No, so I did. Boy, listen, I needed to buy a car because I didn't have one, so I did buy a car. And let's just say I bought a more expensive car than I would have otherwise. I ended up buying, it was 2016, and even then I tried to be responsible. It was a used 2014 Panamera GTS. My dad was not happy. It was one of the funniest things to go back in time now and think. Because I remember him. I told him, he thought I was going to buy a Toyota, a 4Runner, because that's what I told him I was going to do. And next thing he knows, here I am with a Panamera, and I remember him. You are driving a Panamera? You? It's just when I tried to tell him, like, Dad, it was a good price. Like, I did my work, this and that. You? That's still going to be great. And I will tell him nowadays still, because the funny thing about that now is I have an emotional connection to the car, so I couldn't sell it. So I actually sent it to Spain for them, my parents, to drive and for them to have. And it's so funny how he loves it now. And I tell him, hey, remember how mad he was? Like, oh, I wasn't that mad. My brother's there in the background. Like, oh, no, he was pissed. I'm like, I know. It was just one of the funnier things.
Great story.
That is the end of John Rahm episode A. Plenty more coming your way in part B.